Where we had left off was with the third firing in 1945, but we hadn't yet dealt with the beating. But I wanted to go back and first talk about some of the things that we talked about on the phone that time that we didn't record, more about the description of the other stewards that you told me on the phone to make sure that we have that down.
Line stewards at the Briggs?
At Briggs. Mm-hmm. And of the women's participation at the meetings, their attendance. And then a little bit more about that whole aspect. Then you said that you remembered or come across things about the No Such Pledge organizing.
Yeah.
So maybe if we started with some of the material that we talked over the phone about but didn't record about the Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a note here to ask you about Ruth Torchy Bailey.
Yeah, I read there's some reference to her here. I don't know if I got it in the card or not. She was, they had her on a radio program on the No Strike Pledge. Ruth Torchy Bailey, and I know who she is now. It's Ruth Bailey, and they called her Torchy.
And this is on the around the No Strike Pledge issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what if we start with the description we have of the stewards? I have down here two poles, background, one single, one divorced with a son, two married, one with a husband at home, two with a husband overseas, and children. This is notes from their conversation. Maybe we can review something more about the Stewarts. I wanted to try and get a little bit more about the way in which the women did participate in the union, both those who were the Stewarts and the rank and file.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's see. When I'm talking, I'm giving you. I didn't know too much about the organization of the women in the other Briggs plants.
Right.
Our big, huge. We had 18,000 workers in Briggs, and I think we must have had about 12,000 of them in our plant. And so when I talk about the body, it's going to be mainly from my plant, because I didn't know in the Verner Highway, Connors plant and so on, many of them didn't have women, but they did have some sections. But I didn't know.
I wanted to also get a sense of what for instance, one of the things that you mentioned was that they would come to the department meetings, but the general meetings at the union hall they didn't come to, the kinds of issues that would be discussed at the department meetings. And the extent to which that made them feel they were part of the union, and the extent to which missing the meetings on Sunday when they had to do their other chores affected how they felt about the union.
Mm-hmm.
To really get some picture of their participation.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
You asked me the question, so I guess I'm oriented.
Why don't we start with first a description of the women who were the line stewards.
All right. Okay. The women who were the line stewards with me in Department 15, which was a blueprint inspection department covering the Army and the Navy and the Air Corps cribs that were fenced off from the rest of the major area of the working plant, were under surveillance all of the time, you know, by Army, Navy, and Marine Corps personnel. The generals and not generals, but the officers of the Army and the Navy were coming through there all of the time. But they had some very, very fine stewards who could look at an officer in his uniform and realize, in some cases, that their husbands and their brothers were over there without the medals and in the trenches, and their brothers, many of them being foreign-born, were auto workers in Detroit. And they will keep maintaining the conditions for these men to come back to. And so they were not at all intimidated like some you might expect that some people would be. The line stewards were fine in understanding the need for unity in the department. I liked that about, so many of the foreign-born workers have that element about them. They understand the need for organization and unity because they do have the outside world very often when they come from another country. And this you didn't have to explain to them. But on the principles of unionism and exactly how we were going to maintain these conditions and where we could had to draw the line on the foreman giving orders and so on was something that we all went through together and experienced. They, as I said before, didn't come out in great numbers to the general union meetings, which were usually held on Sundays, because as working women, they had other chores around their homes to do. They had time to spend with their children and all of the tasks that are associated with caring for a home and a family. But they would come out to department meetings, because these department meetings were immediate. The problems of the department were immediately in front of their noses all of the time. And when they came out, they would discuss all kinds of things, the language that the foreman used. And this is something that a lot of women don't realize. Teachers, mothers coming out of homes, and women who have never been in a shop condition, in a dynamic situation like a pounding motor division of a factory, and you have to yell over the noise of these great presses in operation and so on, you'll get to the point where you have to shout. You're talking very loudly in a factory, and you have to be very demonstrative when you're talking. And the foremen, who had been trained in this before women came into the plant during the war period, were very demonstrative, very loudmouthed, very boorish in their attitude toward women. And on top of that, they didn't like women. They didn't like to be depending upon them to get work out of their department. And they used the same phrases that they used on men with women when they came in there. We had one tough little foreman. He used to come up and he'd say, "All right, sister, get the rag out." Now, that wouldn't mean anything probably to many women today. But they used to say this to men, meaning you're like a woman, a menstruating woman. In the old days, before women made their own sanitary napkins, we didn't have such things as Kotex and Tampax and things like that. They made their own sanitary napkins out of cotton and gauze. But predating that, women used just cloths, just rags, they called them. And they washed them. They put them in a diaper pail like they used to have to wash diapers, and put them in a diaper pail. And at the end of the period, they would take them and wash them all out. And so they used to say, "Oh, that woman's got the rag on," meaning she was menstruating. And in the shops, it was a very denigrating thing to a man to say, "All right, move your butt, get the rag out." And they talked this way to women when they came in. And it was a shock. It was even though these women were from working class homes where their husbands were beer drinkers and cussed and swore, they didn't hear some of the phrases, the raw phrases that they had to hear from some of these foremen when the foreman got excited about production or output or something. So we would discuss things like that. And of course, there's only one way to handle that kind of man, and that's for a strong chief steward to come up to him and scream as loudly as he, and very often cuss as loudly. As an example, I say, "God damn you, don't you ever say that to another one of my women in this department, period," you know. And if the chief steward could do that, and it wasn't our natures naturally to talk that way, but if we could do that, we could so intimidate that foreman from doing that again by saying, "You're getting a grievance put on you, buddy, and it's going to stick. We don't have to intolerate this kind of persecution and harassment." So they needed this kind of strength. Then our line stewards, following a strong steward, would also be very firm, and they also had to learn how to yell at the foreman. So when the women came to their department meetings, they had many, many questions that they would bring up. Have I got the right to refuse a certain job that I'm not supposed to do? Well, they had to be instructed. You start the job, call your steward, start the grievance, but don't turn down an assignment. And 101 problems that faced them daily, because they, too, wanted to be treated as human beings. And they hated the domination of the superintendents, general foremen, and the other male bosses in there. They hated that domination. It's one thing for a woman to accept it at home from her husband, but to go into a factory, be told by the United States government and the press that you're the glorious patriotic woman that's saving our country by going into the factory, and then facing this kind of domination, it was very difficult for them to take.
How many of them would come to the department meetings?
The department meetings, we would have probably two-thirds. A half to two-thirds of them come to every department meeting. Now, If you stop to think about it, we also had another method in our department. That's why we had such a solid department. At lunchtime, I would have lunch with groups sitting around the tables. You know, we had half-hour lunch periods. They didn't have time to run all the way up the cafeteria, eat, and run back down to our part of the plant. So they brought their lunches, and they set it up right on their work tables, their inspection benches. And I would go and eat with one group of workers one day, another day with another group, and then other times with chief stewards of the anodized and the burr departments, who were black workers, by the way. And we would compare notes constantly so that we could keep our unity of thought and action going. So one way, we kept these people up daily on things that were going on. But when it came to contract explanations and the longer problems, the deeper problems of unionism, and keeping them up on what the local union was doing as far as the general problems of the local union, 212, covering the 18,000 workers, we usually took this up in department meetings, and then a few of them who could get away on Sunday, and usually just the line stewards, would come to the general meetings.
Now,
of the local.
Meetings were held after work.
Yes.
In the department itself?
No, not in the department itself. We had too many company stool pigeons, too many army stool pigeons, and everybody else. No, over in the Union Hall. That meant they had to walk probably three or four mm-hmm. blocks to get down to this Union Hall. It was close by.
And were they weekly meetings? The department meetings?
No, we didn't have to have them weekly. We usually had department meetings once a month.
Mm-hmm. Were any of the issues specifically related to women brought up at the general meetings, or were those usually handled within the department meetings, and then you, as the chief steward, would bring it to the union more informally, or publicly raised in the general meetings?
No, not usually, because you see, when you have, let's see, there were five plants in Detroit, Briggs plants in various parts of the city, and a general amalgamated union, and on top of that, they had supplier plants who were members of Local 212 also. So the Huck manufacturing unit would be part of that. And in the general meetings, or the general council meetings, any of the general meetings, you didn't get a chance to bring up department-wide questions. Those were usually taken up by the chief stewards and the top committeemen of the plant, and we settled them. We had quite a little autonomy, too, within each plant, and they were usually settled there. But when it came to such, we had so many company provocations, company-wide provocations, on speed-up, on all kinds of little things, that this would be the general question, you know, that was affecting all parts of the manufacturing unit. That would be brought up in the general meeting. And then again, we stewards would bring that information back to our department meetings, back down into the department.
So your line of communication, though, would have been, say, through the stewards or directly to you, and then you would take it up with the committee men in that particular Briggs factory.
Mm-hmm.
And then if
then
you
we had
a resolution there, you would go, say, to the general manager of the union? Or was it usually able to be resolved with the committee? Were there ever times that you couldn't resolve it there?
If it couldn't be resolved with our top committeemen. We had five top committeemen in the Mack Avenue plant, for instance, and they were on the walk. They were walking around all of the time checking on departments and grievances and so on. If it couldn't be resolved in the plant, those five committeemen could pull the plant on strike if it got that serious.
Well, were there ever any issues that you and the committee men disagreed over? But did you were you always able to work out with them?
No. They had quite a lot of respect for me. And I can't think of any issues that I didn't get complete backing from my local plant and the local officers, for that matter. And the local officers. No, I can't think of that. We always had good, solid grievances. And if we did, they wanted enough evidence so that when they took it up, they could win the grievance, if possible, naturally. Mm-hmm. And so we usually let a man, foreman, or whoever was the culprit, hang himself to the extent where we had plenty of witnesses, and we devised very good methods for that.
So within the union, there didn't seem to be conflict. You didn't have conflict with the next level of the city.
No, not in local 212. no. Other locals, they did have that problem.
You know, were there were obviously other women chief stewards in the Mackay Indian tribe, weren't there?
Yes, there were. There was one other at the other end, at the Warren Avenue end. And this was these were really the Rosie the Riveters. And they were the unskilled. Our section was in the middle of the first floor of Mack Avenue plant. Theirs is at the far end on the second floor of the department. And that's where they were doing the big airplane, the big bomber plane wings and so on. And it was a very huge area, a very noisy area. And their main chief steward up there. Now, they only had one. Then they had other line stewards, was a woman by the name of Ruth Bailey. They called her Torchy Bailey because she used to be in vaudeville or burlesque or something like that before she came into the plant. And she didn't know so much about the contract, but she was a very personable girl, and the committeemen liked her very much. And she was single, and she went out socially with some of the committeemen, too. And so she got very good service up there in her department. Very good service. She wasn't a well-educated woman, but she was a real working-class, mm-hmm. down-to-earth woman.
So she had not been involved in women prior to the war, was
she? No, she had not.
How about the line stewards in your section? Had they been involved in women?
No, none of them. Not a one of them. No, the women that came into the Detroit, it was called Dynamic Detroit, the Arsenal of America, that was the title. And when these women came out of their homes by the thousands, you had just the pure, raw element of women who had never associated with other women on such a great scale before, never been associated with any organizations as big as a union. And they were very timid, and it took them quite some time to break in.
Did
the whole new world.
Because of your own commitment and involvement and your relationship with them, did they see themselves as an integral part of the union, or did they seem to view it as just holding on to the gains for the men until the men came back and not really seeing any long-range connection with the union?
There was a dichotomy in their thinking there. When they first came in, it was going to be to hold on to the operations for the men, to provide a better living than what their servicemen's checks would provide for their families and their needs and the rising costs of wartime. And they thought of it as sort of a temporary thing. But as they continued and they were able to work out, you see, the federal government through the Landrum Bill had a series of nursery setups all over the country and child care centers. And these women came into the plants because of, they were enabled to by these nurseries. And when they found out that they could work it out very well, their kids were happy, they were happier in most cases because of the care that was given, very thoughtful care. These were good nurseries in the great number of cases. When they found out they could do this and they liked the social contact with other human beings, their paycheck, their independence in the home, then they changed their whole orientation. They would like to continue to have an outside life and to work and to be respected as a wage earner, too. And you could almost see the little butterfly coming out of its cocoon. The metamorphosis was so great, day by day by day. Even women who were grandmothers, older women, just loved the attention that they were given in their families, because these were big wages compared to what they were able to make previously if they had ventured outside their home.
And then did they see themselves as an integral part of the union, too?
Yes, they did. It was in a little different, I wouldn't say a little different way than the men. I would say that the men had a greater percent of activists, because this was the nature of their life prior to this. But the women saw themselves as a cohesive women's union in our department and also in the aircraft. Now, in the aircraft end of it, where the men sort of came in and helped out that steward and they sort of took over the problems, I noticed that those women would look more for the male leadership. I don't know why. Maybe it's because they weren't closed off like we were in this big crib where no one could get in from the outside, and we had to do our own battling. But nevertheless, women did see themselves as, we're going to solve our problems through the union. Like they had just sort of a little autonomy of their own. But they did know that we'd be nothing without the wide body of organization, the union itself. And it carried right over into the CIO and carried right over into the national picture because we used to have these discussions, newer educational discussions. We'd be nothing without the steel workers, the rubber workers, and the rest of the organization of workers. And yes, they did. They felt like that was their union, but they didn't feel that they had a whole lot of control over the international or the local union because they had no women on the executive boards of either one of them at the time. They were all male-dominated. Yeah, but they felt that they could take care of their own backyard right here in their department with their stewards and their teachers. And I never had any jealousy on the part of women that I can ever remember. We had a very fine relationship because I think it's because I had so much respect for women. I had learned that before from my other organization of women in the Emergency Brigade and the Auxiliary.
It sounds almost as if they had developed strength. And they saw themselves, I suspect primarily through you as the chief steward, as being able to resolve their problems, but felt somewhat disconnected from the local.
Yes, they felt as though they didn't do, that their talking to the local would be through me. Mm-hmm.
Was the issue of the race, for instance, of providing the union itself, providing child care during the general meetings or during programs so that they, in fact, could attend?
No. This sounds as though it would have been a logical thing for us to do, but the problems were so numerous, and the whole living in that city was a very hectic experience during that time. We had so many, many big. We had a no-strike pledge given, and we had our labor leader sitting on the War Labor Board, and this no-strike pledge resulted in a loss for the union. Living costs went up 30% and wages went up 20%. So we were 10% behind the times right off the bat. Secondly, because our union had agreed with the other members of the War Labor Board to not strike under any circumstances, the war period, and this is a solemn promise, and the union leaders were enforcing it. They caused a number of wildcat strikes in corporations where the corporation took every advantage of it. And Briggs Local was one of those that had a rough management, an unforgiving management. They never liked the union from the time it was organized. And remember, it was newly organized, all these plants. And so therefore, they were driven to desperation. And Briggs Local had more wildcat strikes, I think, than any other, I'm sure, than any other local in the international. They had the toughest management.
You know, before we get into the whole issue of the organizing against the no-strike pledge, you were saying before that the women were aware of the fact that there were no women on the executive board.
Yes.
And therefore viewed themselves as not having quite being in the same position in the union. How did they react when you were told to withdraw from the race for the executive board because of the whole integration issue? Did they know about that, that you were going to run in that step?
No.
Oh.
There are certain times that you want to keep a cohesiveness, you know, and because many of them came into the plant with prejudice against blacks, I may have told them part of the story, but I didn't make it sound like it was any great penalty or anything like that, because I didn't want to break that very strong unity. And also, whenever a committee man came into our department, and he's the only one now of this whole huge plant that could walk in behind these cribs, when he came in, I always took him around, introduced him around, and tried to associate them with the leadership of the union at every level, you know. And I didn't discuss this openly. There were other bigger issues, like maintaining the unity of this local 212 and the other locals who went along in the demonstrations against the no-strike strikes. Went on the radio, had a big campaign. They forced the international into a referendum vote of its members on that. And I didn't want to break this unity of work. And I was vice chairman of the chief steward's body. And I was on the educational committee. I was voted out as educational director at one point until I myself got another person to take it over. And I had a lot to say with the officers of the union and the council members down there and the educational committee members, the other chief stewards, and they knew what my position was on things, and yet that I had a certain loyalty to the to the group in the local union.
Now, were you part of both the informal and formal chain of command within the union, or as a woman were you excluded to some extent from the more informal channels of communication that they developed?
Well, no, the channels of communication would be formal through the chief steward's body, which was a powerful body, by the way. In that local union, it was, in many respects, had more power than some of the officers, elected officers. And I was the vice chairman of that, and then I was had a lot to do with writing the papers of the Briggs Local, the Voice of Local 212 was the name of it. I wrote some of the articles and had directed the education and directed much of their thinking. I was a teacher of public speaking of the local. And in the assignments, for instance, in public speaking, I gave very highly political and economic topics, assigned them for them to do homework on and come back and give their speech on it while we were learning the public speaking. So I had a lot of influence in the local beyond what would appear from some elected title.
Mm-hmm. What, tell me a little bit about the Chief Stewards Organization. That was of all of the plants?
Yes.
Just the Mack Avenue?
Well, we had both Mack Avenue and we had all plants together, all of the five plants. And that's where we took up, this is how we had to keep track of that corporation, where they were launching their attacks in the most vicious fashion. And they very often would pick on a smaller plant. And sometimes they would have to come back to the big Mack Avenue plant, and that's the one that usually led the strikes when they couldn't take it any longer.
So this was a method of communication for the chief stewards of each department.
Yes.
And each plant to be mm-hmm. communicating with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the committeemen also were involved in those meetings?
Oh, yes. Yes. The committeemen were in on them, too. We even had to have a more immediate and direct form of informal organization now, and that was called the Isleway Caucus of Mack Avenue Plant on that whole first floor, and this plant covered it was 2 blocks long. The whole first floor, at a certain time in the morning, and they would come from every area of that plant, and the very center of the plant happened to be right outside of my department and in the press room. And we would gather there. The corporation knew it because there was a defensive mechanism for us, and we would exchange information. What happened yesterday in your department? What the, you know, what happened with that grievance? What did they do about this? And so on. And this is called the Isleway Caucus, and this was a daily thing. Every single day we had to map out our strategy, so to speak, because of that that corporation being so determined, really, to break down with the wartime conditions. And then also toward the end, in 1945, where they were looking toward retooling the factories again, laying everybody off, they wanted then to come in and launch a real union-breaking attempt. And it came out at the end of 45 in a very, very drastic form. And they fired all over. Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Briggs, they fired their most militant workers on one pretext or another. And there was this general plan started in Bud Wheel, where they provoked the union and every department until Bud, they couldn't take it. They had to call a walkout, refused to bargain on any of them. They called a walkout, and then they fired the most militant people. This became a very obvious pattern that was followed in every shop.
Is that when you were fired for the last time?
Yes, yes. The last time, when this pattern was going on with Bud Wheel and Chrysler and some of the others all over Detroit, we got fired for ostensibly calling a previous strike, being guilty of calling a previous strike. That was the last time I was fired. Yeah.
Okay, before we get into that, why don't we get into the no strike pledge box? Because when we talked about it earlier, there were, I think that you didn't recall as much as probably you all have done. Let me ask them, it sounds like as a result of this Isleway caucus, that you were able to really very carefully plan out the Wildcats. I mean, that's why, in effect, the Wildcats were so possible, because of this constant communication.
Yes. And this is why Briggs Local was such a cohesive, tight-knit unit, too. Always we had this kind of communication. And it was as a result, we can thank the corporation for that, it was a result of it being an anti-union corporation from day number one when it was organized.
Now, and did the formal committee meetings, the formal chief steward meetings met, what, once a week? And then you had these daily caucuses?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then in 1944, I guess, was when all the organizing against the No Strike Pledge really began to occur. To push for referendum.
Mm-hmm. In the late 1944, they organized the UAW rank and file committee to revoke the No Strike Pledge, and that was throughout the International Union by this time. The heart of that movement was in Detroit, and it was led by a man from Chrysler 490. He was the county chairman, and a man from Local 600 was the national chairman of this group. And Dodge, Local Ford, and then Briggs were the top leaders. The men from these locals were the top leaders of that. And they went on the radio, and they forced the International into a referendum throughout the nation, the International Union, on that question. And, of course, there were many charges that the International Union used the mailing list of the paper, of their International Auto Union paper that they mailed out to members. Members during the war period moved a lot of times. Sometimes a man would get five papers and could vote five times, another worker wouldn't get one at all. And anyway, it carried by a small percentage. It's still in favor of the No Strike Pledge. The International Union claimed the victory.
What kind of reactions did you get in the shop during the whole campaign for the referendum from the women?
Oh, from the women. Well, this would be exceptional, I think. They absolutely were against the pledge because we were in Briggs and we were under the gun all of the time. So our women in every aspect of the work of this plant, all aircraft, were against the pledge. I don't know. I never ran into anybody who was for the pledge, in spite of the fact that their husbands were over there fighting. They knew that there were certain advantages that the company was taking at every turn under that pledge, which the union could not avail itself of. And they knew that they were breaking down conditions. And again, in Detroit, we had this huge foreign-born population that felt they were protecting the conditions for their husbands. And when they first came in the shop, many of them thought it was a patriotic duty to put out as much production as quickly as possible and so on. But a little later on, when the union representatives met up with these women, they understood the role of the company versus the role of the union and why their husbands had been able to bring home a decent paycheck because of the union. It was an educational process.
So
great
after
majority of them.
The bridge itself was predominantly opposed to the No Strike Pledge?
Oh, yes. The whole
local.
Yeah. Because the union would not, the company would not bargain with the union in good faith, and they took advantage at every turn. And then they also engineered wage cuts by reclassifying jobs as they opened up new jobs in aircraft, maybe exactly the same operation as they had under automobile manufacture, but they would reclassify for wage cuts. And there were all kinds of provocations like that.
Well, when the referendum won by such a narrow margin, didn't that lead to tremendous divisiveness within the union, since it was so obviously...
In the International Union? Not really, because the rank and file generally, by the time it came to the referendum vote throughout the International Union, was fed up with this no-strike pledge. Because, as I mentioned, their living costs were going sky high, and their wages weren't keeping pace. They knew the company was getting, the company was on cost-plus contracts, and the company was raking in the profits hand over fist, and it became just a general thing that the company was getting all the benefits, and the working people were getting none. Yeah. In our local, now we had so much pressure on the parts of the auto corporations and on the International Union that was still upholding the no-strike pledge. So our local union, they took our president. Now, remember, Emil Macy, the first president, already been shipped off to the Army. And they took our succeeding president, a young Italian man by the name of Jess Barraza, and they slated him for early induction into the Navy. The papers had a big barrage against the unpatriotic people, radicals in the unions, and so on and so forth. The Briggs threatened to fire 30 or 40 of these radicals in the interest of their patriotic duty, and the War Labor Board, the press, the radio, everybody had a constant barrage, because this is the one thing they didn't want, was that no-strike pledge to be removed. And they kept calling on the International Union to take immediate action against the rebellious locals, and ours was one of them, on the rebellious locals. And so the company got the word. They knew when the International Union was telling us, take it easy, that gave them red light, the green light. Mm. Mm-hmm.
How did that affect your specific situation? Were they using that against you, your non-strike pledge organizer?
Who?
The company.
Oh, the company considered me one of the arch rebels of the whole shooting match. Yes, of course. And at this time, in February of 1945, also, the Greater Flint Industrial Union Council passed a resolution, get off the War Labor Board, and this caught up and was going through the ranks of the auto workers also. Get the hell off that board. It's not helping us. We don't want our union representatives up there. And it spread then to other parts of the CIO, and the steel workers, and the rubber workers, and the shipyard workers, and the maritime union. And this was another danger. We became a very rebellious source of a very rebellious grouping there in Detroit, because that was the center of war production. But whatever we did there, we carried out like little waves on an ocean to the rest of the organized labor movement, and it was a very big threat to the war effort and to the government itself.
What was the body that passed the resolution to get off the war board?
The Greater Flint Industrial Union Council.
Oh, it was the council made up of the each of the local
Greater cities. Flint, yes. Five local unions, yes. Mm-hmm. There, you see, Flint had been the battleground of General Motors and had been the biggest battleground. Well, Ford had a certain amount of battling also. But this was the initial one where there were more people wounded and shot and tear gassed and everything else. That was the big Ford, the big GM 37 sit-down strike.
Mm-hmm.
And so that spirit of militancy was still alive up there in Flint. And when they passed that resolution, that swept down into Detroit, and from Detroit it just went out to the other CIO unions. Yeah, get off the War Labor Board. So you see, when you talk about did we have discussions on specific issues in the locals, we had these broad nationwide issues and broad nationwide groupings and caucuses, that we were very interested in participating in, because this was the source of our trouble, our being tied, our labor leaders being tied to that War Labor Board, that no-strike pledge, and the harassment that the company was giving us all of the time meant that it was a union-busting drive. It really was. At first, it was very covered up. And the corporations never liked having to accede to the bargaining of the union in 1937. And they thought they might be able to come back again and get the good old days back again and at the end of the war effort. And at the closing of the war effort in 45, it's when the big offensive came from the corporations. Mm-hmm. And there's the speed-ups were, as one example that I was looking up just recently, in Dodge, for instance, they had one job that went from 108 units, their production schedule, to 184.
Mm-hmm.
And the older men couldn't keep up. And when they couldn't keep up, the company fired them. So what could the union do? If you won't bargain on an issue like that and they're going down and getting your older men and firing them off, the only thing you can do is walk out and stop production. So this is what happened in so many cases throughout Briggs and all of the others, too. Now, strangely to say, within our union, we did have some division in the International Union, and we had certain smaller groupings and local unions, and that was the Communist Party. The Communist Party was for staying on the War Labor Board and for the No-Strike Pledge, and they even called upon the International Union to suspend all officers and locals who were rebellious or who were supporting strike action. And then they appealed to President Roosevelt for a hunt against the element seeking to create a general strike situation in Detroit automobile plants to conduct an investigation against these elements that were doing that. So that was the divisive there.
What did that mean within grapes, for instance? Did you have a CP factor?
We had a small one, very small one, and they were very uninfluential. But they did have in Dodge, and they had in several other local unions, a sizable faction, and they had factional fights all of the time with these groups who wanted to be patriotic and stay on the War Labor Board and sacrifice all for the war effort.
How
was
the SWP faction in Briggs?
The SWP faction in Briggs? Oh, you asked me that once before, now I have to go through it again. Ernie Mazur was in Huck Manufacturing, but he was part of 212. 2, 3. Not very big.
Were they larger? 4. Within Briggs?
Were they larger? We had a hell of a lot more influence. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. We didn't. I don't know if we had so many more people. That wasn't the overriding aspect of it. It was that Briggs was a very militant, coming from the days of Emil Mazur as the leader there. And Emil came out of the Proletarian Party and the SP, very same class-conscious background that we did, and a lot of class-conscious foreign workers who came over from Europe with these ideas of class distinction. We had a far greater influence in that local, of course.
So I was asking again primarily in terms of the implications with the no-strike blood spot, because the CP was supporting the no-strike blood division.